Rector Olson, Professor Baud, my friends, it's truly a great pleasure to be here, to be asked to address this conference and to give a lecture in the name of Dudley Sears. I got a little insight into the importance of Dudley Sears just 5 days ago. I was in Montreal for a small ceremony honoring the life work of a truly distinguished political economist, Carrie Polanyi. And Carrie spoke of Dudley Sears as one of her friends and influences. So I asked her afterwards to give me some more of her perceptions. And I gathered, without going into too much detail here, that if Dudley Sears were here today, he might be sympathetic to some of the arguments that I plan to present. So from that point of view, it's an especial privilege and honor to be asked to give this lecture. The theme of this conference, Rethinking Inequalities and Boundaries, also is something with which I feel a very strong affinity. I began to work on the problem of economic inequality over 20 years ago now, reflecting my unfailing instinct for the unfashionable and the low prestige activity in the field of economics. It has since developed considerably more interest than it was generating back then. At that time, just as the perception that inequalities were rising in a dramatic and disturbing way, initially a perception I think was seen clearly in the United States by the middle 1980s, and elsewhere in the world was an obvious fact long before it was officially measured, was treated by the economics profession largely within a framework of fixed intellectual and geographic boundaries. A debate that emerged in the middle 1990s on this topic was between two points of view, both of which were confined to a framework largely of supply and demand in labor markets. On one side, the proposition advanced by John Bound and George Johnson in the early 1990s, and taken up since by many mainstream economists, that rising inequality was a matter of the interaction of technology and skill, a race, as has later been said, between technology and education. And on the other side, an argument that was advanced substantially and most prominently by my old Cambridge tutor, Adrian Wood, which held that the issue was substantially related to the globalization and the increase of international trade, and essentially the effective supply of unskilled labor reflected both from emigration and from the globalization of production networks. And in the middle 1990s, those two ideas were essentially, if you like, battling it out in the pages of the journals and books. I was asked to look into this debate, to write a monograph on it, and it became clear to me in the course of thinking about how to do that, that it was quite impossible to make a significant additional contribution without first expanding and improving and developing the underlying base of information. And from that insight and the presence as fortuitously of a new group of very talented PhD students, we formed what became the University of Texas Inequality Project, and devoted ourselves over now 2 decades to the exercise of attempting to develop a large scale, consistent, dense, reasonably accurate, and therefore useful body of information on the movement of inequality in the world economy as a whole. I can therefore start by offering you a credo from the philosopher Charles Saunders Peirce, born and raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just a few blocks from where I was born and raised, who wrote in 1877 that Kepler undertook to draw a curve through the places of Mars, and his greatest service to science was in impressing on men's minds that this was the thing to be done if they wished to improve astronomy, that they were not to content themselves with inquiring whether one system of epicycles was better than another, but that they were to sit down to the figures and find out what the curve in truth was. In a sense, a very mundane, very modest aspiration, but one that I will argue has significant implications for how one should think and rethink the problem of inequalities and also the problem of boundaries. Because having restricted the focus of the theoretical effort to specific predefined and pre-categorized markets, labor markets in particular, the economics profession, as it approached this problem, put itself in the position of overlooking the significant possibility that they had got the frame of reference wrong, and that the frame of reference might be on either a larger or a smaller scale. And in particular, that there might be influences and forces at work here which transcend national boundaries, particular so-called labor markets, but that operate at the continental or even the global scale. In order to approach that question, we needed to have give you a sense first, to take you back to that period in the 1990s, of the kind of information that became available on the movement and levels of inequality in the world through the very diligent work of two staffers at the World Bank, Klaus Deininger and Lynn Squire, who produced a remarkable data set, their so-called high-quality data set, from which I've taken here a number of plots. And you can see, at a glance, in a sense, the problem of finding either trends in the data, or in the case of even so well-organized a country as Denmark, figuring out which of the various Gini points one should use for even a given year for a given analytical or comparative purpose. And the other issue, obviously illustrated by Austria or Bolivia or other places, is that there were so many large gaps in the data that even if you had reasonably accurate observations, knowing what was going on in between the years when surveys had been taken was a deeply problematic question. Examples of the same information set just confirmed the impression that the data that one had to work with, and I don't fault it at all, I think in many cases this was very good data for what it was, certainly what it was what is available, was not adequate to the task of providing a basis for a sustained and effective comparative analysis. So what could you do? The insight which has underpinned our work for the last several decades is that it is possible to develop instruments for economic inequality, measures, in fact, of economic inequality, from data sources which are, in fact, readily available for many, if not most, countries around the world, and which are even available for a broad swath of countries on a consistent basis as compiled by international organizations. The data, however, are categorical. They are data for such things as total payroll and employment by industry or total income and population by geographic region. And so one has to be able to work with data that exist not at the individual level, that are not the product of surveys, but that are administrative data collected routinely for other purposes, but from which one can calculate a measure of the inequality across whatever group structure happens to have been created and recorded. And the way to do that is with measure known as Tiles t-statistic, part of the family of generalized entropy measures of inequality, which has the lovely property that it can be arithmetically decomposed into a component within groups, where R is the ratio of the individual income to the average group income, and a component between groups, which is the based upon the population weight of a group and the group average income relative to the income of the whole population times the log of the same thing. That is a very, very simple statistic to compute. It can be taught to any graduate student in 10 or 15 minutes. I always used to say, except for a Russian, or the Russian, it only takes 5 minutes. It's based on personal experience. It's beyond simple. It just requires a spreadsheet and lots of coffee and the raw material of data tables, which can be collected from all kinds of sources. And from on that basis, we've been working to build up information about the movement of inequality across regions and countries of the world for the last several decades. The data computed in this way has the nice virtue that it can be presented graphically in such a manner as to be decomposed by sector or by region. And here I've done something which is available only by this technique, using NUTS1 regional data available from Eurostat's Regio database, decomposed into 6 sectors to show the contribution of each sector to the overall level of inequality across the entire continent of Europe without distinction by country. The sectors that lie above the zero line are above average income, and all the others are below average. This one, which is blue, is the financial sector. And you can see the effect of the crisis in reducing the level of inequality in the European continent by reducing, for a short period of time anyway, the income of the financial sector relative to what it had been at the peak of the boom. It's a very clear and simple and straightforward way of illustrating the movements of relative income across this very gross sectoral classification and over time. It also gives you a sense, right there from the beginning with respect to the European continent, of the importance of finance, of financial sector incomes, in the overall movement of measured inequality as measured across the total spectrum of European payrolls. The same thing can be done by regions. This is the same sort of chart, only done across 254 European regions. And once again, you can see that actually just two of them bear a significant part of the load in explaining the story of the evolution of inequality in Europe. And the one that contributes the most is the city of London, which is not a surprise given that it is one of the two major financial headquarters of the world. The city of Paris is also very significant. Much more important in terms of the overall influence on inequality in Europe than any of the other metropolitan areas or regions that are available in the data set. So it's something which, again, brings out in a graphically clear way what is happening as time passes over a specific region. We started very early working on major developing countries, and this is data collected from the State Statistical Agency of the People's Republic of China, published. Initially, we got it on rice paper, but more recently, of course, it's been available on the web in their state statistical yearbook. The Chinese data are, of course, suspect, but not for this purpose. And we feel quite strongly because, first of all, they were not collected for the purpose of measuring inequality. That's something we did. And secondly, our findings largely are now being confirmed by the slower moving but still effective process of collecting survey data. What we found was that there are two sub-peaks, if you like, in the movement of inequality in China, which begins to rise very dramatically in the early 1990s, peaks across regions in the early 2000s. This is the regional between provinces measure. And that is because the initial growth of incomes, which is concentrated in places like Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangdong province, spreads out over a wider geographic distribution, Zhejiang, Tianjin, Fujian province, amongst others. And then there is a second peak in the inequality across sectors, which comes with the crisis in 2008. There's a growth of inequality due to rising relative incomes in banking, utilities, and so forth, and that peaks, transportation, that peaks in 2008. The overall effect, when you add them together, is that there is a peak in inequality in China in about the mid-2000s, something which very recently, we started publishing about this in 2007 or so, and in 3 or 4 years later, survey data begins to come out, which confirms that this is largely an accurate picture. To show you another country of considerable interest, there's China geographically. You can see from 1987 to 1997, using a color scale, where yellow and red represent the prosperous areas, and the blue areas are those that lag behind. You can see the dramatic increase in regional disparity that occurs over a 10-year period. Another country for which it is very interesting to look at this data and from which very good data are available over the transition is the Russian Federation. And this is another way of expressing the same data across something like 70 regions of Russia, oblast and krai and so forth, rayon, with the data at the bottom being the individual sectors. And you can see that in 1990, before the transition, finance was at the bottom of the Russian income scale. Agriculture was roughly in the middle, and the whole thing was extremely compressed compared to 2000. By 2000, agriculture has fallen to the bottom. Finance has risen to the top, and a handful of regions, this is Moscow, and particularly finance in Moscow, construction, and energy production in places like Western Siberia, are what is driving the extraordinary increase in inequality in the Russian Federation over the transition period. Okay. That's just by way of introducing you to the flexibility and, I think, power of this technique. What we sought out to do next was to find a data source which could be used to compare countries across as much of the world as possible. And that data source existed and exists in the industrial statistics of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization in Vienna, which has been systematically compiling this information for a long period of time. So we obtained it, and using the industrial categories, which admittedly are quite limited in their scope, they don't include agriculture, they don't include services, but nevertheless, we will show, produce an inequality measure which acts as a reasonably good instrument, not only for what it measures directly, inequalities of industrial pay, but also for inequalities of household income insofar as we can determine, and I'll give you some evidence on that in a few minutes. What I'm going to do next is show you some maps. And the maps show not the levels, but the changes in inequality over the entire surface of the globe at 6-year intervals, beginning in the early 1960s and going up to 2008. And this color scale is the same all the way through, so try to make it easy to pick out what is going on in the data. Light to dark blue are decreases in inequality. Yellow to orange to red are progressively larger increases in this measure of inequality. And so all one needs to do is to observe over the 1960s, there's a period of decreasing inequality, equalization is going on. It begins to weaken in the late 60s. In the 1970s, there's a definite split, the 70 to 76, between oil-producing countries. You can see the band across North Africa and Southwest Asia, and the consuming countries, India, the United States, other places. The energy crisis that continues in the late 70s, the debt crisis hits in the early 1980s and transforms the picture in a dramatic way, particularly in Latin America, in Africa, and in fact all over the world. You're now moving into a period of rising inequality practically everywhere. And what will happen next will probably not come as a great surprise, because in 1990, this is 1983-89, in 1990 we had the transition in Eastern Europe, and then shortly afterwards the transition in the Soviet Union, and you can see the dramatic increases in inequality that occur in that part of the world over the course of the first half of the 1990s. So what I would suggest that we're observing here is something which is quite clear once one illustrates it in a reasonably transparent and straightforward way, which is that movements of inequality, insofar as we're looking at industrial pay, are in fact movements that occur at the regional, the continental, or indeed at the global scale. And they occur in ways which are highly correlated across geographic regions. So it would not be reasonable to treat the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe as separate entities here. They're undergoing the same process for the same reason, and they're both all experiencing rapidly rising inequality. Similarly, going back to the 80s, one has specific events that are related to a global phenomenon, namely the global debt crisis of the 1980s, which has its reflection in this, these data which measure inequality across industrial payrolls. Perhaps not surprising conceptually when you think about it, but definitely something which is a rethinking of the effective boundaries of economic change, and also necessarily a rethinking of the causal factors that lie behind them. If one goes on into the late 1990s, the rise in inequality begins to soften a bit, and then in the 2000s, it actually reverses in substantial parts of the world. This is the last I've got, is 2003 to 2008. And you can see that for various reasons, good or bad, the major period of rapidly rising inequality, at least in this data, appears to be over provisionally at this time. So it is not the case that inequality is always rising everywhere as a feature of capitalism. It may be the case that particular phases of policy and of transition have effects that other phases do not. It may specifically be the case that the period of enthusiasm for the Washington consensus, for the neoliberal policies, for privatization and deregulation as a response to crushing debt burdens, produced across the whole globe rapid rises in inequality, which were not reversed in full, but at least stalled and to some extent reversed by the period in the 2000s when large parts of the world, Latin America, in Russia and in China, which had never really adopted a neoliberal model, reversed course and moved away from that domain and direction of economic policy. So it may well be that what countries and regions and institutions do has an important effect, but also it may be that credit conditions changed around the world and commodity prices changed around the world. And so the conditions for improving inequality were much better in the period from 2000 to 2008 than they were in the 20 years before that. All right. How does that data relate to the problem that many economists are deeply concerned with, which is household income inequality? The answer that we offer to that is based upon a statistical relationship between our measures and, for purposes of convenience, the original Dininger and Squire World Bank data series, about 400 and some observations, exactly overlapping with respect to country and time, from which we're able to calculate that relationship and then to go and estimate a data set for household income inequality from our measures of inequality of industrial pay. I won't dwell on the regression analysis except to say that the variable that's of interest here is the relationship of our measure of inequality to the World Bank's measures, and it's a very stable relationship, very stable positive relationship. Ours is more volatile than Gini coefficients, which are damped, but they move in parallel. The other variable that's important is the degree of industrialization, which we measure as manufacturing employment to population. The more you have of that, the more equal you're likely to be. The rest of it is simply dummy variables to adjust for the different types of data that are available on the basis of surveys, in particular whether the data are based on income or on consumption, whether they're based on households or persons, whether they're gross or net of tax. Overlapping observations about 430. From this, we're able to compute an estimated data set of household income inequality with almost 4,000 observations. It will have 4,000 of the next update over the years now from 1963 to 2008, and we're working up to 2012 or so. But, one question. Once you do that, are your measures any good? Do they correspond with what other people are measuring, what other people have measured? And here, I'm afraid I'm going to inflict upon you a long series of rather messy charts. It will give you a sense for just how messy this literature is. One of my students, actually two of them, Beatrice Halbach and Alexandra Malinowska, went into this literature with a kind of passionate intensity and simply copied every inequality number they could find for a whole series of countries, classified them very carefully according to the type of measure, and then plotted them on line graphs so that we could see whether our estimates fit within the range that the established literature had found. So let's just take the wealthy countries first. Here's one. Here's Canada. And you can see there are basically three types of measures in the survey literature. The green are market income, which I don't like very much, but it's very high. It's the income that is excludes income from government sources, so pensions and so forth are not in this in that measure. The red is disposable income. That's after transfers and taxes. And the blue is gross income, which is after transfers but before taxes. Our estimate is the black measure, and it sits right where it should be, in the middle of the various estimates of gross income inequality. It also has essentially the same trend in the Canadian case as the gross income inequality measure. So if that is the pattern over a whole series of countries, I'm going to offer it as evidence that our very simple model, which just is based on two coefficients, one of them being inequality of industrial pay, which is the active coefficient, does a very good job of capturing both the level and the movement of gross income inequality. And now we go through and show you the mess. This is Denmark. You can see Denmark's a very highly studied country, but there are lots of different measures, and they're not exactly the same. So one has market, gross, and net, and ours falls nicely in the middle of the gross. Similarly, France is a country with very sloppy measures, but we're again in the middle. Germany is a country with excellent measures. I like them because ours lies exactly along the line of the gross income inequality survey. This is the late and unlimited Deutsche Demokratische Republik. You can see it. Inequality declined to the point where the country collapsed. Greece, sloppy measures, but our model seems to work pretty well. Italy, similarly, Japan, Netherlands, Spain, Sweden. I don't know why Sweden's measures are as sloppy as they are, but they are. The United Kingdom, we seem to be exactly on track. For the U.S., slightly complicated picture because our measures fall, while they track up to the early 1990s, they fall below most of the other measures in the late 1990s. The reason for that is that income in the United States, measured income, which is extremely well measured, includes a very large share of capital asset income, which we're not capturing. And most countries' income measures simply don't have that in it, either because people don't have the capital asset income or because it's not effectively recorded by tax authorities, which it is in the United States. These are the CBO's numbers. And you can see a peak for the boom of 2000, a peak for the boom, the mortgage fraud debacle of 2007, the collapse afterwards. Okay. A second group of countries, very interesting, the so-called transition economies, is one which are countries which were moving away from socialism, and they have a very different property. Here's the Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic, insofar as they don't have welfare states with large tax transfer mechanisms, so the gross and the net are very close together. Our measures, however, still are very close to both, and that is true for Hungary, it's true for Poland, true for Russia. You can see the chaos of the Russian transition. You can see, similarly, the chaos of the Ukrainian transition, essentially the same phenomenon, both countries, massive increases in inequality over a brief period in the late 80s, early 90s. And then there are many developing countries. I only show a few of them. Our measures are, again, pretty good for Argentina, pretty good for China. In India, it's an interesting case because there's only one actual data point available for India that attempts to capture something approaching gross income, and it's that one. It's the Luxembourg Income Studies data, and it's very close to ours. The Indian official data are based on consumption, and they're much, much lower. And India is not unique, but almost unique in relying on consumption-based inequality measures. It's obviously highly misleading to compare them to income measures. I was extremely pleased when the Luxembourg Income Study came out with something that tends to support our claim that India has a very unequal income distribution. And I have to tell you that I gave this talk, and a fellow who was responsible for that number came up and told me how pleased he was to see mine, because he needed the support as much as I did. In Mexico, you have very messy numbers, all of which come from a single survey, the INEGI of the Mexican government, and the differences are based entirely on the way different researchers draw on that survey. Ours tend to be, well, okay, close, maybe not too close, we're not. In some countries we're low. South Africa, for example, we're below the consensus measures. But I would argue that for most of the developing world, we are reasonably within the consensus measures of gross income inequality. And our measures have the advantage of being much longer and continuous in time series and directly comparable from one to the other. So from a research standpoint, it's an extremely useful, I think, I would argue, useful exercise. If you look at the average over all the countries, it's a somewhat illuminating exercise. You can see a turning point here and a turning point here. This is the breakup of the Bretton Woods system, the commodities and debt boom that followed through the 1980s. And then from 1980 to 2000, you see basically rising inequality, which peaks after 2000. The reason this comes down in this period is that you're adding in low inequality countries from the formerly socialist world. So that brings down the average. All right. I could do a more sophisticated measure, but this is just to give you the idea that there are definitely global trends here. And when you look at the turning points, it appears that those trends are associated with the major movements of global finance. That is to say, with the way the world economy is governed, with the breakup of the Bretton Woods system, there was a period of strong instability which ended in a vast crisis, which went on for 20 years and went around the world from Latin America and Africa to Eastern and Central and Eastern Europe, and then finally to Asia in 1997. In 2000, again, a turning point, interest rates fell, commodity prices rose, and the conditions made it possible for governments that were so inclined, Brazil, for example, to pursue policies once again that reduce poverty and inequality in their domestic spheres. All right. I want to give you an overview of the household income inequality numbers. These are now on a scale that is simply the familiar Gini coefficient. Dark blue is the lowest numbers. Red is the highest. Yellow, orange, red, a natural gradient. And you can see in the 1960s a world in which the advanced countries had relatively large middle classes and relatively low inequality measures. And the countries of the tropical and developing world had the opposite, relatively small, if not non-existent, middle classes and relatively high inequality measures. These are just decade-by-decade averages. So to give you a picture of the coverage of the data over time and what's happening to it, again, something which is visible, and you can see, as we go into the 1980s, and particularly into the 1990s, there we are, as the Eastern world comes into the data set in a clear-cut way, that things are really changing. And in the 2000s, the world of the 2000s looks much more like the developing world of the 1960s, with only just a few countries here, Sweden, Finland, maybe one of the Baltics is in there, that Czech Republic, that continue to have measured levels of household income inequality that were comparable to what most of the advanced world had in the 1960s. So the world really has become more unequal over, and particularly as a result of this vast period of rising inequality in the neoliberal era of the 1980s and 1990s. That's the broadest picture I can draw for you. But I want to say now a word or two about causal mechanisms. Because showing the trends and showing the turning points, I think, carries some weight, but it is helpful to develop the argument with a greater degree of intensity and detail. And yet another one of my students, a very talented Argentine named Maria Delfino Rossi, after a brief term as a director of the Argentine Central Bank under Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner at the age of 26, came back to finish her master's degree and decided she would do something useful. And what she decided to do was to tabulate exchange rate movements and see if they matched up to our inequality measures. And I suggested a hypothesis for her that would explain why this might be the case. The hypothesis is very simple. If you look at the industrial pay scales, if you look at the structure of industry, any country has two industries, those that export and those that don't. And it is a general rule that countries export their best products and their highest paid workers are in the export sector. So when there is a decline in the exchange rate, a depreciation, the exporters instantly have more income because the foreign income, the dollars or the euro that they're earning, go up in local currency terms, whereas those who do not export are still being paid in the local currency, in the peso or in the renminbi. And that being the case, the inequality will rise. So one ought to expect that the exchange rate and the inequality measures are correlated. The question is that correlation something that is systematic and is it strong? So that's what Delfina did, and here's what she found. I'll just go through a series of countries in alphabetical order. A upward sloping line is a, let's say, support of our hypothesis. So there's Bangladesh, there's Brazil, there's Cameroon, there's Canada, there's China, there's Czech Republic, there's Hungary, there's India, there's Ireland, there's Mexico, there's Peru. Particularly the smaller Romania, developing countries, this relationship is just exceptionally strong. There's Singapore. There's the Netherlands. Okay, it's not so strong for the Netherlands, but that's a dollar exchange rate. And there's Tunisia, and that's before the euro, of course, Turkey, Uruguay. Okay, one exception, Italy. I won't need to remind you what Richard Nixon said he thought about the lira. But in any event, the fact is, it's an overwhelmingly strong relationship. And not only is it strong, it captures a very large share of the variance in industrial pay. And I've already shown you that the variance in industrial pay is a very good predictor of the variance and even the level of household income inequality. So I want to suggest to you, since there's no possibility that the exchange rates are driven by inequality, that the causal arrow here clearly must run from the movement of the international financial markets, currency markets, to the structures of pay, particularly in vulnerable developing countries, and from there to the structures of household income. It's obviously not the only thing that's going on, but it is a powerful enough force to suggest that it cannot be neglected in any serious discussion of what should be done to alleviate the rise of inequality around the world. And it also suggests very clearly that if you look at the picture in the last year or so, in which the currencies of the rich countries have been rising and that of the United States particularly, and the currencies of the developing world have been falling, that when we are in a position some years from now to update this data, we're going to find that the inequality hasn't risen again dramatically. But I think it's obvious that it has. If you look at Latin America, confluence of economic and political events are driving inequality up and reversing the gains of the last 15 years. That's what's going on in the world. And what's going on in the world is a demonstration of the power of finance. And unless that power is controlled and regulated, it will come back again and again to undo the work of progressive social movements, progressive governments, trade unions, social development forces, by making it harder and harder for poor people to keep up with the wealthy. It's a very straightforward argument, I think, and one which the data have lent a considerable, one to which the data have lent a considerable amount of support. Okay, I got one other thing. This is a digression. This is a digression because I've come here from the land of Trump, and I'm sure you want to know what's going on in the United States. This is a comment about the effect of inequality on American election outcomes. And we did a calculation to take account of the fact that in the United States, presidential elections are decided state by state in the Electoral College. And so one has to ask the question, does the inequality or change of inequality in a state have an impact, or is it related to how each state voted in the last election? The last election was characterized by a campaign of extraordinary anger that's often referred to as populist, and often associated with rising inequality. So I think if I asked you whether you expect a state which had very sharp rise in inequality to be more inclined to vote for the Democrat or for the Republican, I would guess, based upon the few times I've asked this question of other audiences, that most of you would say that the rising inequality would tend people, make people angry to vote for the Republican. And that's a very common sense response. I hope that's the one you had in mind. But as you will see, it's exactly wrong. This is a map of how the counties of the United States voted: red, Republican; blue, Democratic. And what we did was to calculate the change of inequality from employment and earnings data in the United States on an annual basis by state, data which were not previously available because some of the states were too small for survey-based measures, and then associate that change from 1990 to 2014, with the election outcome. The blue diamonds are the Clinton states, the red circles are the Trump states. And the interesting fact is that the 14 states with the largest increases in inequality, every single one of those states was a Clinton state. Every single one. You look at the labels here. There's New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, California, Maryland, Rhode Island, Nevada, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Illinois, Virginia, New Hampshire, and Oregon. The Trump states down here with the lowest increases in inequality: West Virginia, Wyoming, Oklahoma, Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Kentucky. And then there's a group in the middle which are contestable. And it's interesting that the states that Trump won, decided the election, Pennsylvania, Minnesota didn't win, but it was Ohio here, were states where the rise of inequality was relatively less. And a state like Texas, which he won, was a state where inequality has actually been increasing, and it moved toward the Democrats in this election. What do we make of it? I would suggest that there is a relationship, but the relationship really reflects the structure of American politics. The Democratic Party is a coalition of the rich, liberal, urban professional and the immigrant and the minority, the African-American community, relatively poor. When those two communities are dominant in a state, that's a Democratic state. When those two communities are weak in states which are largely rural or where the urban and work industrial population has been falling because of deindustrialization, that's Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, those states are drifting to the Republicans. So I think we have an index which is not only good for analyzing financial power, but also has a certain amount of interest in analyzing the way in which political developments unfold. And I think it's true not only in the U.S., but you can analyze the Brexit vote and the French elections and other elections through the same general metrics. So I just hope that encourages you to think that there is some prospect for data-driven work in economics and some prospect for help for using that information to help us understand the dilemmas of the world around us. Thank you very much.